This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about property law. In this part one, we'll be covering questions on landlord and tenant laws and on property ownership, touching on boundary disputes. I'm here today with Mr. David Sawtell from Land Chambers in London. David is a senior barrister who specialises in property disputes, and he has a wide range of extensive experience in this area. He regularly publishes journals, and he has written a book on the subject called A Practical Guide to the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you for inviting me.
Excellent. Wonderful. So let's start. So the first, now property law, obviously for both landlords, tenants, homeowners, whether it's privately or commercially, it's a really big area of law. So what we're going to try and do today is cover a couple of headings and break them down just a little bit. And the first one I thought would be useful to cover, David, is landlord and tenant law. So in landlord and tenant law, one of the most commonly asked questions is, my landlord wants to evict me and I have nowhere to go. What can I do?
It's a very important question, and it really does touch upon some of the most important issues we have in property law, because it's not only a financial investment for a landlord, it's a tenant's home. And there's been a great deal of controversy and argument about landlord and tenant law in this country, and lots of people now are thinking maybe it's becoming out of date, maybe it's anachronistic. But when you help and advise in these sorts of cases, look at it from both sides of the coin, it can be quite difficult. And the law in this area is technical. It's not always straightforward.
There's a lot of variations, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, what kind of tenancy contract do you have? And what kind of tenancy contract are you protected by? Because there is lots of protection for tenants. But it depends. If you have a standard tenancy contract, a short hold tenancy, I think they're called, you know, what can you do if your landlord says, right, you're going, I want to get rid of you, and it depends whether they give you the notice period that they're supposed to or whether they haven't. I mean, it can branch out into various ways, can't it?
Absolutely. There's a great amount of difference between a commercial tenancy, which has its own body of law, and a residential tenancy.
Yeah. So if this is a residential tenancy and your landlord says, right, I'm getting rid of you, but you've got nowhere to go, what can you do? What do you do first? Obviously, in the first instance, is perhaps you try and talk to your landlord and say, can you allow me, is it the 2 month or the 3 month period to try and find a home? And if they say no, and if it gets... I guess the question is coming from if it gets contentious, if there's an argument where the landlord will not allow you enough time to find a home to move to as a private tenant, what can you do?
First question you're always going to be asked, wherever you go to for advice or looking things up online, is what kind of tenancy do you have? And there's a great distinction between a long leasehold tenancy, that's one which is over 21 years in length, and a shorter tenancy.
Could you get those on private tenancies, private sort of rentals, a long leasehold?
Absolutely. If you are a leaseholder, if you own a lease,
oh,
you own
a
flat. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But as a tenancy contract, it depends what type of tenancy contract you have. So if you've got a standard tenancy contract, say, what do you do if you've got nowhere to go? If your landlord is saying get out.
If you have a private landlord, then most of the time you have what's called an assured short hold tenancy. And if you have a written agreement, you can look at that. It should normally say if it's what's called an AST or not. And that's the starting point, determining the rights between yourself and your landlord. The good news is there's a great deal of information out there. You can go to a local housing authority if you require assistance, even if you are a private tenant.
Emergency housing, you're saying, you know, in that sense.
I mean, even for advice and assistance, even if they can't provide you with housing, they can give you help. They can tell you which places you should go to. They can tell you where there's a local assistance advice bureau. And they can be extremely helpful and effective in helping you. The government also publishes a great deal of information online. So the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government produce a document called How to Rent, the Checklist for Renting in England, which you should have been provided with by your landlord anyway.
And when most of the time they don't know, David. You know, private landlords, they advertise in all sorts of ways. And one of the problems that we come across with clients is that clients say, well, actually, I don't have a tenancy agreement in place. I don't, because when I first rented the property, we signed up and everything was great. Now we're in the third year. I never renewed that. I mean, I guess the question we're asking here is, if you're asked to leave and you have nowhere to go and live, because you were told not given enough notice perhaps, could you go to the courts and say, I would like to be granted more time to find a home? That's possible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you must remember that a landlord, a private landlord, cannot simply go in and change the locks. They cannot simply throw you out on the streets. That's unlawful eviction. They have to go and get a court order.
Whatever, to get you out if they want to evict you quickly for whatever reason it may be.
Absolutely. And you do see, and we see in practice, many instances where landlords will simply come along. They will simply turn the locks and the tenant finds the possessions in black bags outside.
God, that happens a lot, doesn't it? And it usually happens with the private landlords that advertise online and, you know, with no agency, there's no real protection there for the tenant, having rented through an agent or trusting a landlord or going renting a room in a property where it's quite common, where there's lots of rooms for rent in a larger property and they rent a room and they're given something that looks like a tenancy contract. But there is a lot of protection out there for tenants, actually, that a lot of people are not aware of, because obviously being told you're going to be made homeless if you don't listen to the person that's renting your property to you can be quite frightening, can't it? And quite disruptive to your life.
Absolutely. But if you know something a bit more about your rights and you look into it and you know it cannot simply get you out without a court order, that gives you time and it gives you the opportunity to look into it a bit more, to get legal advice or assistance if you can obtain it, and if it's private, whether you can afford it or not.
But even if the landlord's trying to get a court order to evict you quickly, for whatever reason, and we're not looking at why the eviction is happening here, we're just looking at you've got nowhere to go and you've been told that you're going to be evicted, you have the opportunity, don't you, to go to court and represent your side of the story to the judge when the landlord is making that application.
Absolutely. If they're going to court, they need to serve what's called a claim form on you, so they can send it by post, they can put it through your letterbox, and it will explain to you why the landlord says they are entitled to take back the property and grounds on which they are depending on. So if it's come to the end of your term, that might be one example. Or if you're in rent arrears, it could be another example.
Or they might be selling the property and they've committed to selling it without tenants in the property.
But even before we even get to that stage, they should have served what's called a notice on you, which is, can be quite a short document, but it should tell you...
Is that a Section 21 notice? Is that what you're referring to?
There are a number of different documents depending on what the landlord is relying on. The most common is a Section 21 notice, and that now has to be produced on a certain type of form, which should say on it what the tenant's rights are and how they can go and get advice.
Yeah.
So if the landlord is saying, you have an AST, it's come to its end, I want you to move out, and if you refuse to move out at the end of your fixed term, they service notice on you, it should say on it, when is the date you're expected to move out?
Yeah.
Why the landlord says you have to move out? And the form will also say where you can go and what advice and assistance you can get.
Yes,
what the landlord simply cannot do is force you to leave.
With nowhere to go yourself and without a court order. I mean, it is illegal for a landlord to just turn up, change the locks without a court order and put your belongings on the street.
Absolutely.
That's what we're saying. That is not lawful. Landlords cannot do that. Yet so many of them actually do, because we do take the phone calls to people in these desperate situations, and you know, they think that the landlords do have the right, because I guess the general mindset is that the landlord's got the right over the tenant because the landlord effectively owns the property. No, that's very helpful. I mean, and then we go on to the next question, which is also another common area for tenants, actually, and it's, my landlord would not make repairs to the property, what are my rights? And we're talking about, you know, not jazzing it up and changing the colours so they suit your requirements. We're talking about broken white goods, you know, essentials, your fridge, your freezer, your washing machine, your cooker. You know, they are essentially considered white goods. Or, you know, you don't, your boiler, your hot water isn't consistent, or your heating, you know, things like that. So what can you do if you're a tenant and you have a landlord that just will not make the necessary repairs?
Unfortunately, we see that again so often, and we see that regularly in practice. I've been acting recently for a party who was in bed when water started dripping through from the ceiling and the plaster started coming through from above her.
Gosh.
And it's a real problem. And it doesn't matter how expensive or how inexpensive a rent is, these issues can arise.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced it myself when renting. You have issues with damp, of issues with cold, of issues of the heating not working. And tenants should be aware of their rights, whether or not you have a written tenancy agreement or not.
Or not, right? Because that's important, isn't it? Because we had a situation where the tenant was given a very good property at a discounted rate. What the tenant wasn't made aware of, that the property was rigged with problems. And every time the tenant tried to say, but there's a big issue here with the sewage, there was issues with the heating, the sewage, the flooring, and all sorts of things, the landlord will say, yes, but that's why you're renting it at a discount.
Well, that simply isn't how the law sees it. If you're renting and it's a short lease, then the Landlord and Tenant Act 1985 implies a number of covenants, which are terms in a contract between yourself and the landlord, and they can't escape from those. So, for example, Section 11 of that 1985 Act says they have to keep and repair the structure and the exterior. They have to keep and repair installations for supply of water, gas, electricity, hot and cold water.
Basic stuff. Yeah, so leaks are not acceptable, or no matter what your rent is, whether you're paying a lower rent or whether you've got an agreement in place or not.
And quite often the landlord will come back to you and say, well, the problem is my superior landlord should be dealing with these problems and they're not dealing with it.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? And when you say my superior landlord, what is it you mean, David? What does that mean then?
Well, quite often if you have, say, a block of flats, then each one of those flats might be under a separate lease coming out of a freehold. A freehold is the overall building itself.
Yeah.
And someone might buy a 99-year interest in a flat.
And somebody else, a company or an individual could be, owns the freehold of
yes.
the building.
And the person who owns that longer leasehold interest in that particular flat then sublets it or gives out a tenancy agreement to someone for a shorter period of time, say 6 months.
Most flats are leasehold, aren't they? The majority of flats in the UK are leasehold. So if you own a leasehold flat, or your landlord does in this case, and they rent it out to you, that you've got to be careful that your landlord doesn't always blame the freeholder, or doesn't get the freeholder to do their obligations to put your property back in order in the way that it needs to be.
Absolutely. If they're not getting redress, if they're not getting any help from their superior landlord, that shouldn't be your problem.
Yes, yes.
So your contract, your tenancy agreement is with your landlord. So you can still put a lot of pressure on your own landlord, and they should then in turn put pressure on their own landlord.
Yes, because a landlord should have the basics in a property, no matter what your rental agreement is, how low it could be for a grand property. Whether you have an agent involved or not, whether you rented through an agent or whether you rented through a private landlord, your hot water, your heating, you know, the draft through the windows, if you've got broken windows or something, your basic white goods, if they're part of the rental contract. Because not all rental contracts have fridge and freezers and washing machines in them, but these things have to be in good running order. And there's also, from my knowledge, that a minimum time period. So if you're without hot water, what is the maximum time period, should we say, that a landlord can wait before they fix it? How long, you know, can they leave you without hot water or heating, maybe, David, in the winter months? Is there?
Well, first of all, you have to give notice to your landlord to activate any of these rights. There's no point simply suffering in silence. You have to tell them, and then they get a reasonable period of time to come in. And that does depend on what the problem is. So if, for example,
say there was no hot water, you've got no hot water, you've told your landlord, how long is a reasonable time, would you say, or does the law say, that has to be put right, that hot water has to be back in that property?
Most agreements I've seen suggest it's between 24 hours and 48 hours.
So it's not that long.
It's not that long at all.
From the time that you notify?
Yes. Obviously, if there is a real problem, for example, if it's mould and it's a problem with windows, then it'll be a longer period of time.
Yes, of course.
But if it's simply that the boiler is defective, for example, then it's a much shorter period of time, and the landlord needs to get on top of it.
Yes, well, that's very helpful. That's very, very useful. Okay, so another question. I have found a private landlord via an online advert, and the landlord does not want to issue me with a tenancy agreement. Should I rent this property a room? Now, the person asking this question, actually, this is very common where people rent rooms in large properties. They often find landlords looking to rent these properties or these rooms online and through various channels. And they turn up and the landlord says, well, you're only renting a room. This is the amount. We've agreed the amount. Usually the bills are included, i.e. the electricity and the hot water and the use of sharing a kitchen or a bathroom. And this can happen to students quite a lot. And the landlord does not want to give a written agreement. Do they have to give a written agreement if demanded? And really, logically, is it correct to say, I'll just rent it without an agreement?
They don't have to give a written agreement. You can enter into a tenancy agreement without it being reduced to writing. But my big question is, why? Why don't they want to give you a short piece of paper explaining what your obligations are and well as what their obligations are? Because it goes both ways.
That's
the agreement should say what the rent is or what sum of money you're paying every week or every month. It should say what your responsibilities are in terms of keeping property in good order. And if the landlord isn't interested in that, then you have to ask, what kind of landlord are they?
Yes, and I think that's really important, actually. Why? Why do they not want to give you anything in writing? Because what I have seen on some occasions is that the landlord that poses as the landlord isn't actually the landlord at all. And what I have seen is that with some estate agents, more and more now, when you turn up to an estate agency and you say, I want to rent my property, they ask you for a mortgage statement to prove that you're the owner of the property. Because there's been a lot of illegal subletting where they are the actual tenant of a property and they then go and rent it out without the knowledge of their landlord, without the agreement from their landlord, to somebody else. And I think that's got to be right, where you say, why doesn't that person, even if it's on a sheet of A4 paper, to say, this is the address, this is the monthly obligation or weekly obligation of rent, this is what's included, why wouldn't they? I think that's really important.
And that's a problem both for landlords and for tenants when you have unlawful subletting. So if we take one of the scenarios we see quite regularly, a landlord lets out a house, and it could be to a company, it could be to an individual, they could know it's going to be sublet, or they could might not know it's going to be sublet. Let's say the landlord lets it out to an individual as a house. That individual, once they're in, puts locks on all the doors.
We had a case like this actually a couple of years ago where a 3-bedroom semi-detached house was converted into 7 self-contained apartments.
And
extraordinary it was, actually.
And you can probably assume they're not going to have the appropriate planning application. If they make any modifications and building control, not going to be involved. There are issues as to fire safety in that kind of multiple occupation. And there are a lot of question marks that arises about the health and safety of the people who are going to be living in there as their home in that property.
Well, I tell you what happened in this case. When the landlord turned up to pick up some post, because it was the first, they actually rented the property through a very, I won't say the name, but it was a very reputable high street estate agent. They rented it to somebody who said he wanted to rent it. This individual then converted it to 7 self-contained flats, rented each one out. The landlord goes back to pick up their post because they've just moved out a few months ago, and sees doors everywhere, literally. In their 3-bedroom semi-detached house, all of a sudden there's doors everywhere, and it's been partitioned left, right and centre. And the agent tried not to take responsibility for what had happened. They said, well, we just found the tenant. But ultimately, what ended up being the case was that the manager and the agent of the branch was in cahoots with the guy that was subletting. But this, you know, it actually happens more common and often than we think it does.
Absolutely. And what then tends to happen is it becomes what's called a house of multiple occupation. It's under the Housing Act 2004, an unlicensed house of multiple occupation.
Which is a criminal offence, isn't it?
It is indeed.
For the landlord. So if you're a landlord, and landlords, you should really be listening to this. If this happens without your knowledge, even if you have no idea about it, and the council find out that your property is rented out as multiple sort of self-contained rooms without a licence, you are criminally responsible for that.
And the maximum sentence is 6 months for that offence.
I'll tell you, it's frightening, that is, because I know actually quite a few people where they don't need the presence of their big home in the UK anymore. They're spending more and more time abroad, so they're renting their homes out, sometimes through agents, sometimes privately, and this is happening to them, and they have no idea.
And it then becomes incredibly difficult to make for people, the tenants who are living there as their homes, to leave that property again and to stop that illegal HMO from continuing. So it's a problem for the tenants, because you can probably assume it hasn't been...
Well, the tenants were served with a Section 21, David, and you're talking 7 rooms were vacated within 7 days. So if you are a tenant in one of these properties where it's being sublet and you're in a multiple occupancy property, you're not aware that it's licensed or not, you could be asked to leave very, very quickly.
And if it is unlicensed, then the landlord isn't entitled to serve a Section 21 notice. Section 75 of the Housing Act 2004 says where there's an unlicensed HMO, then the landlord is not entitled to serve a Section 21 notice. What you also see if you are the overall landlord and it's been unlawfully sublet is if your tenancy agreement didn't prohibit that unlawful subletting, so it's not unlawful subletting at all, it's simply subletting, is that even if you terminate that lease, you're then left with these what used to be subtenants now going to be your tenants because of Section 18 of the Housing Act 1988. I think part of the problem with English landlord leasehold law is it's become very complicated with lots of statutes overlapping with each other and each one typically modifying the effect of the other, but it might be quite difficult to empty out an HMO if you are the overall landlord and unknown to you it's now become an unlicensed HMO. It's definitely worth taking specialist legal advice on that.
Oh, definitely, absolutely. And also, you know, if the council found out that that was the case and you're not aware, if you are taking specialist legal advice, at least the council can prove that you are not aware, and here's the advice that you're taking to try and resolve the matter, because, you know, it's a criminal offence to have an unlicensed multiple occupancy property, whether you know or you not know. That's frightening. But let's try and cover a question on property ownership, David. And one of the questions that I'd like us to try and cover is, I'm thinking of buying a property with my partner and or a friend. I will not be on the mortgage. What can I do to protect my interest in property? Now, this again is another really big area, because what we're seeing is that lots of people tend to trust each other when they're doing something like this, particularly if they're in a relationship. And they say, oh, that's okay, the mortgage is going in your name, but it's our home. The deposit potentially, in this case, let's assume the deposit has come equally, all the expenditures to purchase the property with the solicitor's fees and the moving in fees And then all of a sudden, you know, that relationship breaks down. But before we even get to the breakdown of the relationship, how can you protect yourself if you're buying a property? It could be a sister, could be a brother, could be a cousin, could be a parent. How can you protect your interest in that property if you're not on the deeds, if you're not on the mortgage?
I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of misunderstanding in this area as well. When the Law Commission produced a report on this field, they suggested that people still think there's a concept of common law marriage.
Oh, I've covered that, yes, and no such thing.
Exactly right. If you're even if you're living together in a property and you've been sharing in the finances, there's no protection in that respect. We have to go down and look at extent of beneficial interests and equity, and it becomes more difficult. And there's also been an area of the law where in the last 15 years or so, there's been quite a lot of movement.
So I just mentioned to our listeners that you may want to pick up and listen to our podcast on cohabitation and separation, because we do look at, you know, that question of common law. But what about a deed of trust?
Yes.
What is that? And actually, it can help, can't it?
A deed is an agreement with certain formalities, so special ways of producing it and getting it done, which the parties say, this much is mine, this much is yours. And it's extremely difficult to go behind what's on that deed unless it's been obtained by some kind of fraud.
Yes, yes. So essentially what we're saying is, you could get a deed of trust drawn up. So if you're buying a property with somebody, you're not going to be on the mortgage. Your name isn't going to be in the land registry because you're not on the mortgage. Go to a legal expert, and you can come direct access to a barrister to do that. You can go to a law firm to do that. And you say, please draw up a deed of trust, which will actually detail everybody's interest in the asset. And in this instance, we're talking about a property. And therefore, your interest will be protected on that deed.
And they're not that expensive.
No, they're not. They're a couple of £100. I mean, a few £100, really, if a simple, in this case, isn't it?
And if you think of it as insurance for your beneficial interest, which could be worth hundreds of thousands of pounds, or potentially millions of pounds, depending on the value of the property.
And not only that, it also, you know, it comes into play, and God forbid, you buy a house with somebody. We had a client actually last year, bought a house with a gentleman many years ago, planning on, you know, just buying a few properties together and doing a bit of business. And the gentleman that the property was in the name of passed away very unexpectedly. If it wasn't for this deed of trust, there'd be no protection for the other person.
Absolutely. It isn't a question of, do you trust me, do you not trust me? It's a question of, well, what happens if, as you say, someone passes away?
Or there's a fallout.
Or there's an insolvency.
Yes, I mean, God, that actual question, I would like to cover that actually in another podcast, because it's huge, and we can branch off again, as you can always do so with legal matters, and we can cover so many subsections under that are very useful and helpful, and I think, you know, it's helpful to know. The last question that I want us to try and just touch on at this stage, because we are running out of time today, is my neighbour and I are in a dispute over who owns the land in between our properties. How can I look at who actually owns the land? How can I look at resolving this matter without involving lawyers? And let's try and keep it on a simple example here, David.
My best advice about boundary disputes is not to get involved in disputes about boundaries. If they litigate or they go to dispute resolution, they can become so expensive
so quickly.
And, of course, if you're setting on the property and you ask one of the standard questions, has there been a dispute about the boundary, and you are forced to disclose this, what's revealed on the land registry, immediately there are questions raised about it.
But what's the first thing you do? I mean, the land registry is a portal, online portal, government-owned body, which people can download documentation from to show who owns which property, bit of the property, and where, right? So would the first port of call to see who actually does own that bit of land at the side in between you is to get your land registry, copy of your land registry, to show the outline of the property?
It's a very good starting point. Land registry plans, depending on how the original conveyance took place, are not necessarily perfect. They're not necessarily going to be definitive, and they're down to a margin of error on many occasions, but it's a good, very, very good starting point. Look at, if you can obtain it from a land registry, how those properties were conveyed and conveyed into plots. But even if it looks as if it's clear from the documents, someone, this part belongs to that person, that other part belongs to the other person, if someone has occupied it for a very long period of time, they might be able to argue a case based on adverse possession, which is where if you occupy an area of land for a long period of time, it effectively extinguishes the property rights of the other person.
Wow, and the point, that's massive. That's huge.
So we see disputes ranging from extensions to closing off fields to a number of other instances as well, where one party says, well, it's absolutely clear from the deeds, this is mine. But the other party then says, yes, but this building's been here 20 years. You can't now come along and say this belongs to you, because yes, your title has been extinguished, which I think is...
that's where the arguments can start. And I mean, I guess if people say, I don't want to go to lawyers, I don't want to spend money on legal fees to do this, then I guess the first stage is get your land registry documents, the both of you, then perhaps sit down with a mediator. Maybe that's the first stage, and that way you both pay for the cost of a mediator. You can split it equally, but you try to mediate the problem.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
A very first initial step there for people. But yes, I mean, look, there's so much that we haven't covered, David, and we are going to cover in future podcasts. So thank you very, very much for your time today. And what I'd like to say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. And thank you very much for listening.